Today I'm talking to Dr. David Abrutat. Born and bred in Scarborough, David is GCHQ's chief historian. Scarborough has what is believed to be the oldest continuously operated signal collection location in the world. Opened by the Admiralty in 1912, it moved to its current location at a former Scarborough racecourse site during World War II. Since then, it has continued to expand to help keep the UK safe. From 2001, it has been officially known as GCHQ Scarborough, but it is referred to locally as the wireless station or the listening station. I'm hoping to understand how important the Scarborough listening station has been to the UK's security. David, a signal station was opened in Scarborough in 1912, 2 years before the start of the First World War. Why Scarborough, and what activity did it undertake in Britain's war effort during World War One?
Well, good morning, Hugh. So the Admiralty originally bought the land in 1911 and opened a site in Sandybed Lane in 1912. Global communications at this time, there was a big reliance on something called high-frequency radio, or HF radio, which allows global and regional communications because it uses a layer of the atmosphere called the ionosphere to bounce signals. At the time, it was opened as a communications site for the Admiralty, and where Sandybed Lane is over the top of Falsgrave Park, it was geographically and topographically quite well positioned to collect signals of this type. But it, as I said, it originally was a communication site for the Admiralty to communicate with the ships of the fleet in the North Sea. But in 1914, at the start of the First World War, it was transitioned into a SIGINT, or a signals intelligence collection site, which predominant focus was looking at the German high seas fleet operating in the North Sea and the Baltic. And obviously there was a lot of harassing ships coming across the North Sea during the first few months of the First World War. And, you know, the famous bombardment of Scarborough and some of the other eastern coast towns of England by the High Seas Fleet, there was a significant threat from the German Imperial Navy at the time. So the site became strategically very, very important for the Admiralty.
And is there any possibility that the attack, that bombardment of Scarborough in 1914, was in any way connected with the fact that the signal station had been set up?
There's been some interesting debate with historians, and I don't think there's been any direct proof, but certainly I think it was the year before the First World War started, there was a ship here in Scarborough with a lot of German tourists on board who were asking a lot of questions about the site. A lot of that's, I think, hearsay. I don't think there's any documentary proof, but I know during the bombardment there were a number of German naval salvos that hit very, very close to the site and in around the top of Falsgrave Park and in Sandybed. Whether they were directly targeting the site is open for debate. Certainly, it makes a good story.
It does. Tell me, during World War One, then, were there any special stories that we should be aware of?
Well, one of the main buildings that's still on the site is called a cottage, which was the old the officer in charge of the OIC. It was his house. And the ground floor of that, there were around 25 radio specialists dispersed on the ground floor in various sort of operations rooms that were, you know, receiving the signals, processing them and trying to interpret and translate the German. And became very, very active during that First World War period and suddenly proved the value of having a permanent site there. But certainly, I think at the height of the war, there were about 100 radio operators at the peak at that one site. And there are some really nice photographs that have been found in the Scarborough Library archive of photographs of the original members of staff at the site. And it was really the beginning of the journey for signals intelligence. It was really becoming a discipline in the First World War. And the information that was encrypted or enciphered by the German Navy. We were working with a new code-breaking unit that had been established in the Admiralty in London, which was called Ream 40, because the cryptanalysts or the code-breakers were based in Ream 40. And this was the beginning of a new organisation that would form at the end of the war called the Government Code and Cipher School, GCNCS, which would become GCHQ after the Second World War. You know, people will associate my organisation with Bletchley Park. Well, the Government Code and Cipher School were based at Bletchley Park for 7 years, 1939 to 46. So, you know, the First World War was the genesis of signals intelligence, but it was also the genesis of cryptanalysis or code breaking, you know, the breaking of codes and ciphers used by our adversaries.
In 1932, there was a proposal to close the Scarborough station and transfer operations to Hampshire, a decision which I understand was later overturned. What was the motive for the proposed relocation? Why was it reversed?
Well, in the 30s, the site was that there was a new commander brought in called Commander Rogers, or Jock as he was known, and he picked up the site and he used the term Cinderella. It wasn't well invested in, it was poorly resourced in terms of equipment and skill, training wasn't being given to staff. And there was a proposal to close the site in Scarborough and revert operations to a site, a Royal Navy site, in a place called Flowerdown in Hampshire. Fortunately for Scarborough, the site wasn't closed, the decision was reversed. And things really started to pick up in the late 30s as Britain was preparing for war. We had the Munich crisis in 1938, and there was a big uplift of staff at the site, and a batch of retired ACSWS, so that's the Admiralty Civilian Shore Wireless Service, who typically were retired wireless operators from the Navy, who were brought in as a civilian batch into the station. And really things started to pick up during the Second World War for obvious reasons. You know, the focus of the site at this time was German Navy, but also Naval Air Force. Being an Admiralty site, the natural synergy is with your target being a Navy target, so developed from there.
We know that the listening station was very important during World War II, and the station was critically important in the sinking of the Bismarck, for instance. So can you describe then how that signal interception was undertaken to enable that to happen?
Yep. So there's two aspects to this answer. So the station was involved in the interception of signals from high-frequency radio traffic from the German Navy and Naval Air Force transmissions, which might be from units that were operating in the North Sea or some of the North Sea ports or even the Baltic, because of the way propagation works, which is the way the signals are bounced off the atmosphere and come back down to land. Scarborough was ideally placed for that, being right on the coast, being in the position it was. They also carried out something called direction finding, or DF, which is where they will pick up the transmission of a radio signal from a number of different aerials around the same aerial farm. They get the same signal hitting those aerials, and they then do a parallel bearing on each of those signals because of the time delay, which provides a fix on a position. And the most famous story during the Second World War is that Scarborough was one of the sites that contributed to getting positional fixes on the Bismarck, you know, the pride of the German Navy, which led to its sinking on the 27th of May 1941. But the site became big at this stage. There was something around 60 staff on each watch, and became a very important part of the Royal Navy's signals intelligence effort. There were a lot of different sites around the UK, and the encrypted traffic would be passed to Bletchley Park. Bletchley Park was opened on the 15th of August 1939. Government Code and Cipher School. Anything that was relating to German Enigma traffic that had been encrypted using the famous Enigma machines would be passed to Bletchley for decryption. And it gave us a massive strategic advantage because we could understand secret communications, the stuff that the Germans wanted to keep secret. And it provided us with a big, big step forward.
And how did output from that to Bletchley?
There was two methods. For the timely material, stuff that was time critical, it would have been relayed by teleprinter traffic direct to Bletchley. If it was less timely and less mission critical, it would have been sent typically by dispatch rider, so motorcyclists would have gone with paper copies in their little pouches, driven all the way back to Bletchley.
During the war, the station was relocated to a bombproof site, which is where it is now on the racecourse, and that happened in March 1943. Did this indicate an increased risk of attack to try to neutralise the station, or was it simply a recognition that its work needed to be protected against interruption?
That's a good question. Certainly it needed to be protected from Luftwaffe attack, albeit there were bunkers at the original site. I've spoken to a few residents that live there, and they know and have confirmed that there are bunkers underneath the Roblau flats that have been built on the footprint of the old site. But we needed a more resilient site and a bigger site as well. It was cramped, the old site, it wasn't really fit for purpose, and the site needed to expand massively. So a parcel of land had been bought up in part of the Raincliffe estate on Ayrton Moor, just off the racecourse. And on the 1st of March 1943, the operations from Ayrton Moor were moved during that day directly across to Ayrton Moor without a skip. It's a massive, obviously a huge project in its own right, but the fact that they never missed a skip, I think it's, you know, tantamount to the professional approach they had to reorganise the staff and the site. And a lot of the operators there were female. They were Women's Royal Navy Service operators. And the site was called HMS Paragon, so it had a sort of naval badge as well. And just prior to the site opening at Ayrton Moor, there was another famous story for Scarborough, which goes back to August 1941. And it relates to a convoy called OG-17. 1871. So there was an armed merchant vessel within that convoy called the SS Aguilla, and the convoy was setting off from Southampton and transiting down to Gibraltar and then onwards to Singapore. And there were 21 wrens on board that SS Aguilla, and 12 of those wrens had come from Scarborough, from the site at Sandybed. And unfortunately, on the night it had been spotted, the convoy had been spotted by a Focke Wulf German aircraft, a reconnaissance aircraft. And 2 days after being spotted, a U-boat, which was U-201, attacked the convoy and managed to sink the SS Aguilla on the 19th of August. So it's the biggest loss of life in my organisation's history. It's a story of Scarborough and the sacrifice that was made during the war. But it's also interesting what happened next. The Wren organisations, the Women's Royal Navy Service, decided to create a memorial fund for the 21 Wrens that had died, and they commissioned the build of a RNLI lifeboat, which was given the name the Aguilla Wren. And it was commissioned and put into operation at Aberystwyth Lifeboat Station, many years there, and then it moved up to Redcar in Cleveland. And then it was retired in service and, given to the Sea Scouts, and it fell into disrepair till a chap called Tim Curtin bought it, and because his father used to serve on it in Redcar, and it was in memoriam of his father that he bought it, and he wanted to restore it. So he got it restored at a restorer based in Northern Ireland, and it's a fabulous 39-foot-long, beautiful lifeboat, and it's really a living memorial to the girls that die, but also to Scarborough and to the site, the GCHQ site. So there may be more to come on that one, that story.
That's an interesting and not well-known story, I suspect, around Scarborough. After World War II, the world experienced what was referred to as the Cold War. We know that the Scarborough station was a key in tracking Russian activity during the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Tell us a little bit about that Cold War period.
Yep, the Cold War instigated a massive shift for the organisation. At the end of the war, there was a British signals intelligence. There were tens of thousands of people working in it. And obviously demobilisation and the rapid shift towards looking at the Soviet Union and the threat during the early stages of the Cold War rapidly transformed the organisation, which was known as the Government Code and Cipher School, but it became GCHQ officially in 1946. But the site rapidly transitioned to focus on Soviet Union traffic and Navy, particularly Soviet Navy, as a mission. And what the one big story during this period, which we have put into the public domain, is the story of the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962. We've always had, since 1946, and the formal agreement that we've had with the Americans, which was called YCUSA, which is a SIGINT alliance, essentially. There was a division of effort in place to, we can't cover everything. The Americans can't cover everything. So there's, for lots of strands of our work, there's a division of effort. And in terms of the Soviet Union and the Navy and merchant shipping, Scarborough was given responsibility for tracking and monitoring Soviet merchant ships in the North Atlantic. Fairly mundane task, lots of fairly low-hanging fruit in terms of reporting. In October 1962, it became massively important. We're on the verge of the Third World War. We've got merchant ships being used to transfer medium-range ballistic missiles across the North Atlantic to Cuba. A big standoff between Khrushchev and Kennedy. Kennedy obviously didn't want strategic missiles to be positioned on Cuban soil, and it became a standoff which nearly escalated into nuclear war. But there was a key piece of intelligence which is worth mentioning and involved the site. So they had responsibility for tracking merchant ships, and one of those ships they were monitoring as routine was a ship called the Kislovodsk, and it was transiting across the North Atlantic from one of the Baltic Sea ports with medium-range ballistic missiles on board for Cuba. And the operators at site were monitoring the positions of the ship every 24 hours. And on the 24th of October, right at the height of this escalation, at the point where the world was concerned that we were going to nuclear war, the Kislovodsk had literally turned on a sixpence and was the DF positions were northeast of where it was 24 hours before. So it essentially turned round. And it was one of the first indications that Khrushchev was standing down. So the report that came out of Scarborough would have been fed to our counterparts in America, NSA, the National Security Agency, and it hit an analyst called Juanita Moody, who was one of the main analysts involved in the Cuban Missile Crisis in terms of signals intelligence. And she read the report and instantly noted how important this piece of information was. And there was a chap called Adlai Stevenson, who was the American ambassador to the UN, who was going to brief the Security Council the next day. And she wanted this intelligence to get to him, and she managed to track him down to a hotel, I think in New York, but he was asleep. And she tried to get the security service guys that were looking after him to wake him up to get this intelligence to him. But it's a fabulous story and just really relays the fact that our little site in Scarborough is involved in one of the most important stories of the Cold War.
Yes, indeed. So coming to the present day, how important is Scarborough Station to the UK security infrastructure, and how do you see the future of GCHQ in Scarborough?
Well, Scarborough's part of our wider enterprise. Our main headquarters is in Cheltenham. It has been since the early 1950s. But we have sites in the UK, places like Bude and Scarborough, and now in Manchester and London. But we've got sites overseas as well. And they're all sites like Scarborough and Bude in particular are sites that are involved in collection of signals. But increasingly so, they're more and more involved with our missions. So we've got a very, very broad brush mission with things like counterterrorism, serious and organised crime, support to military operations, of course, strategic advantages. So this is looking at our key adversaries, and no surprises to know that two of the main ones at the moment are Russia and China. But increasingly, we're doing more on cybersecurity. The birth of the National Cybersecurity Centre in 2016 has brought in sites like Scarborough into that mission. So it's really changed and transformed the site in the last few years in the way it works with the broader GCHQ enterprise and also our partners, not just in the UK, but overseas as well. So it's a busy site. It's really rapidly transformed in the last few years, and also doing things like a lot of outreach with schools and Cyber First programs, focusing on STEM, working with local schools, universities and colleges. And it's really moved it in a newer direction. And transforms, I think, one of the key employers in the town as well.
David Abrutat, Chief Historian for GCHQ in the UK, thank you very much for sharing what is such an important part of Scarborough's heritage in the stories that you have told us today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hugh.